Hello everyone, welcome to my video, How US Debt is a Sign of Its Strength. Recently I read the magnificent 37-page introduction to the book Super Imperialism by Michael Hudson. It's the third edition, published in 2021. Now I found this introduction mind-blowing and shared some of the pages on Twitter, and I had numerous requests to try to explain what he's talking about in simple terms in a video, because some of this material is admittedly quite complex. Now, I think I've got my head around most of it, but if I do make any mistakes, finance bros, cut me some slack here, because this is some rather difficult and obscure stuff. But let us make a start. Now, before I get into the history and get into some of the mechanisms, it's very important to understand what a US Treasury security, whether it's a bill or bonds, various other instruments, we need to understand what one of these is. And I'm going to explain it as if you were a child who doesn't know anything at all. Okay. So governments can issue these things called bills or bonds, and other governments, foreign governments or individual investors, can buy them. And typically the reason you buy one of these is to make a little bit of money every year. And that bit of money that you make every year is known as a yield. You get a certain percentage of yields over a certain number of years. So let us pretend, for example, you bought $1,000 of 10-year US Treasury bonds at 4%. You'll get $40 back every year for 10 years, giving you $400 total, plus the original face value of $1,000, which you'll get back when it matures, for a total of $1,400. Now, I've deliberately simplified this. In the real world, typically you'd be paid twice. You'd be paid $20 after 6 months, and then the other $20 after the after 12 months. Also, it won't actually be fixed at 4% like that. You'll get a certain you've got a certain amount of time where it's guaranteed at 4%, and then it kind of varies with inflation and various other things that will make the percentage fluctuate. But in theory, this is how it all works. Okay, hopefully you are following me. So let us carry on. The issuing of U.S. Treasury securities is done by an investment bank, for example, Goldman Sachs, one of the famous investment banks. Let's pretend that the Bank of England bought 1 million 1,010-year US Treasury bonds for $1 billion. The Bank of England would buy these bonds from an investment bank, Goldman Sachs, like I said. There is now $1.4 billion of US debt sitting on the Bank of England's balance sheet, minus any fees paid to Goldman Sachs. In other words, the government of the United States, the US Treasury, owes the Bank of England $1.4 billion, and it will pay, you know, the equivalent of 1,000 times $40 every year back to the Bank of England, and then, you know, after 10 years, it'll give the rest of the money back. And there is now $1 billion sitting on the US Treasury balance sheet, again, minus any fees paid to Goldman Sachs. And these are, in theory, ready to spend on government projects, although in practice, as we'll see, they seem to go into this giant black hole of debt. So let's have a look. What are the current US debts? Currently, the USA is $34 trillion in debt. That means that many people own US Treasury securities, bonds or bills. A bill is basically a shorter term bond, you know, 3 months, 6 months, over a year, something like that is a bill. But essentially that means that this is the amount of money the US Treasury owes to all of the individual investors and foreign governments in the world. Now, there are currently $2 trillion in circulation in the real economy, around $1 trillion of which are held in the USA. That's the money that you're getting paid in from your employment, that you're buying your groceries with in the shops. That's $1 trillion, that real economy there. And there's another $1 trillion held internationally. And similarly, that is money that is in circulation in places where you can use dollars. For example, Zimbabwe uses dollars as legal tender. The money you can buy at an exchange in the airport, those US dollars also exist. Okay. Hence, the USA currently has 17 times the debt that there are dollars on Earth, theoretically at least. Okay, so let us continue. The USA runs a huge balance of payments deficit. So you can see, if you include all its goods and its services, its balance of payments is about minus $1 trillion. We'll talk more about that as we go on. Nearly 60% of all foreign exchange reserves are in US dollars, with China holding over $3 trillion. China thus holds more US dollars than there is circulation in the entire world. There is more debt sitting in the Bank of China, central bank, than there are total dollars in circulation in the world. And you can see those numbers there. After China, Japan, Switzerland, various other countries hold, so many dollars. Okay.
Are you sick of hearing about Marx and Keynes? Do you want to know why neoclassical economics is so flawed? Have you ever wondered how to work out the marginal productivity of a burger bun? Do you want to level up your econ knowledge? Buy it now. £350. Foundations of Economics. Foundations of Economics.
I'm here.
Foundations of Economics. Get it now.
So what does all this mean? How does all this, which, you know, on paper looks pretty bad, I think everybody would agree, how does it all mean strength for the USA? And really, this is what the book Super Imperialism by Michael Hudson explains in a way that I had never quite understood. And I'm going to try to explain it to you. So first, let us go to classic imperialism, as run, for example, by the British Empire. How did they used to do their debt? The British Empire used to loan a colony, okay, and issue a loan to a colony. The money that was lent by the British Empire would then be used as a capital investment to specialize in a specific good. For example, the Gold Coast, that's Ghana today, was pushed largely into cocoa production. Cocoa sold by the Gold Coast then back to the United Kingdom. So that would be an export by the Gold Coast, an import into the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom would then turn those raw materials, in this case cocoa, into chocolate bars. The United Kingdom would then sell chocolate bars back to the Gold Coast and indeed across the empire. And using David Ricardo's competitive advantage, his theories of competitive advantage, it basically did that across the empire. You know, the Gold Coast would do chocolate, another place would do sugar, let's say, and all of those things then would be, exported back over to Blighty, where they would turn them, using its manufacturers, into finished products, and then export those finished products right around the world. That was the model of the British Empire. So its status as a creditor, i.e. issuing the loan, was used for a geostrategic and economic purpose, i.e. to transform the economies of those places, often into cash crop, single good economies, which would then rely on the United Kingdom for all other products. Just classic imperialism. That is what colonialism was in many cases. Now, in contrast to that, the USA, as a creditor after World War I, behaved rather differently. In the interwar period, the USA gave loans to the European powers, who were in dire straits, to the value of $11.5 billion. Now, unlike the British, the USA showed little interest in using loans as capital investment, but followed an isolationist policy. The Americans had this idea that they weren't going to be like the bad old European powers, and instead they pursued an isolationist policy, protecting American interests specifically, not wishing to, it didn't want to turn Britain, for example, into a specialist in cocoa or anything like that. So instead, what they did is they demanded full interest repayments from these loans as a creditor. And then if anybody couldn't pay, they would then use that as leverage. This had negative consequences for world peace because by the 1930s, the European nations also became protectionist, and this laid the foundation for World War II. Now, obviously, there were many other things and factors that led to World War II, but the United States, as the chief creditor in this period, set the tempo by behaving in a mostly isolationist manner, which then caused all of the other economies to protect their own interests. So, you can see how war follows from tariff wars, which is what happened again. Partly also, and Hudson discusses this in detail in the book, it lent on Germany in particular. And, you know what happened there. You ended up with a German government that was simply just refused to pay. Just defaulted. I'm not going to do the repayments anymore. That was Schacht, I believe. Okay, so let's carry on. Now, after World War II, the USA again became the chief creditor. And this time it was determined not to repeat its previous mistakes, i.e. it had learned that, if you set this protectionist tempo, that's going to cause problems because you're just going to get war again. So they were trying to devise ways for a more peaceful way of doing things that would lock in the European economies into greater interdependency in trade. The US embarked on a policy of giving loans, most famously the British loan, Marshall Aid and the Marshall Plan, largely with a view that the money would be spent on US imports. In other words, during this period, the USA was essentially paying European nations to buy its own goods. The IMF and the World Bank were set up for this purpose, although, as we shall see, its mechanisms were used in a great many other ways moving forward. And you can see this cartoon in the top right here basically explains the relationship. They were getting stuff. The Europeans were basically broke during this period. Britain was close to being bankrupt at this time. So the best way that America could help was by sending stuff. And that is essentially what happened. So, gold. In the post-war period, nations settled their balances with the US in gold. By 1949, the US had accumulated three-quarters of the entire world's gold reserves. This practically bankrupted Britain, as I just mentioned. By 1950, European nations were reverting to protectionist measures once more. And since the USA had so much gold, the dollar could now be accepted as a key currency in lieu of gold. So during this period, America had, when you've got 75% of the world's gold reserves, you can be trusted as a creditor. You're not gonna run out of money anytime soon. And you can also be, perhaps more importantly, trusted as a debtor, i.e. if you take a loan from someone else, you're not going to default. So basically, if people during this time, well, we're going to back America, they could be like, well, I'll buy US Treasury securities, bills, bonds, etc., because the American government is not going to go bankrupt with 75% of the world's gold. It's not going to default on its commitment, its repayments, its debt obligations. So during the 1950s, as you can imagine, given this scenario, this unique scenario, the US started running for the first time a balance of payment deficit. The balance of payment is the difference between the inflows and outflows of a nation, including all trade, investments, borrowings, and other transactions. Now, despite its vast wealth, the USA needed to keep its allies flooded with dollars so that they could buy its exports. In other words, if Europe didn't have enough dollars, it couldn't buy American stuff. Right? And I'll explain this a little bit more on the next slide. But chiefly, this is an issue with liquidity. There needed to be money sloshing around in order to buy stuff. And when Europe was hard up, basically America needed to supply this money somehow. The Korean War shifted the US balance of payment into deficit. That is, the USA was spending more money than it was taking in, and it financed the difference by issuing US Treasury bills, IOUs. And I've already explained what those are. Now, gold, which was still technically on the books here, turned out to be causing a liquidity problem. If payments were tied to gold, it created an issue for the USA. To get more money into the world trade system, it would have to buy more foreign goods itself, which it didn't want to do. If the USA could find a way to pump more dollars into the system without compromising its trade advantages, that would solve the issue. So basically, how do you get more money into France without buying French stuff? How do you get more money into Britain without buying more British stuff? Okay. Note the USA at no point actually believed in free trade like it was supposed to, or the market or anything like that. And Michael Hudson does a fantastic job of showing just how top-down managed this whole system was from the very beginning. In 1960, there was a run on the dollar, which pushed the price of gold to $40 an ounce. By 1964, US debt to foreign central banks exceeded the value of gold stocks held by the Treasury. So now you can see that there was more debt held outside America in US treasuries, securities, than they had gold stocks. So that idea that America had so much wealth, so much gold, that it could never default was now suddenly in jeopardy because literally there was more debt than gold. This is a problem. Now, to cut a long story short, there are lots of other things that happened in between 1964 and 1971. I'm going to skip right ahead to the upshot of all of this, which is, of course, Tricky Dicky ended the convertibility of US dollars to gold in 1971, aka he ended the gold standard. And now the dollar became fiat currency, which I'm sure you are all aware of already. Now, during the 1970s, there was something called the Nixon shock. In 1973, a large volume of dollars flooded the world market, pushing down the dollar against all other currencies. So the dollar was devalued against the pound and against the franc and all the other currencies that were around back then. Now, this is actually good for the dollar and bad for those other currencies because it makes American goods cheaper and it makes foreign goods more expensive. So it's not always a bad thing to have a devalued currency. In fact, the price of pound sterling being too high was a constant problem for Britain from the end of World War II right up until recent times. The sterling, pound sterling, was overvalued and essentially engaging in all of these loans and so on with the United States, thanks to Mr. Churchill and various other people, essentially waived the UK's control, its ability, let's say, to have some modicum of control over what happens to the pound. So huge bit of sovereignty lost during that period. And naturally, with the pound being very expensive and already declining and hurt British economy, was struggling to sell its products and goods. That's just one example, but it basically happened to most of the quote-unquote allies of America during this period. The USA used this situation as leverage against European nations. They would not stabilize the dollars and stop quote-unquote pumping unless they gave special treatments to US imports and to guarantee American farmers a fixed share of food consumption. So they were basically using the manipulation of being the reserve currency of the world to its advantage because they had control basically over the world economy, because it had the reserve currency and it could cause all sorts of problems just by releasing more and more dollars into the system. So they basically had all of the European nations over a barrel over this time. And like I said on Twitter, you know, when your grandparents and parents were suffering during the various recessions and stagflation of the 1970s, most of it went on keeping, some American boomer happy, thinking that he was responsible for his own wealth. But it was a form of coercion, as you can see there. Note, this was the exact opposite of the 1930s, where the USA had used its creditor status as a leverage. And this is one of the things that Michael Hudson is fascinated by, that the USA has basically reversed the classic. I mean, usually, if you're in debt to someone else, the person you're in debt to has the leverage, right? The creditor has the leverage, as we saw in the 30s with the USA. But since the USA has become a debtor, it actually is somehow using that as leverage over all the creditor nations. And Hudson seems to think that this is quite unique in world history, as I'll tell you about in a moment. The United States achieved what no earlier imperial system had put in place, a form of global exploitation that controlled debtor countries by imposing the Washington Consensus via the IMF and World Bank. While the Treasury Bill Standard obliged the payments surplus nations of Europe, OPEC, and East Asia to extend forced loans to the US government. Against dollar deficit regions, the United States continued to apply the classical creditor leverage that Europe and Japan were unable to use against it. Debtor economies were forced to impose austerity to block their own industrialization and agricultural modernization. He's talking there, the debtor economies he's talking about are Africa and third world economies, okay? The creditor nations is basically Europe, Japan, and a few other nations, the OPEC, Middle Eastern oil-rich countries as well. Their designated role was to export raw materials and provide low-priced labor whose wages were denominated in depreciated currencies. Against dollar surplus nations, the United States was learning to apply a new, unprecedented form of coercion. It dared the rest of the world to call its bluff and plunge the international economy into monetary crisis by not channeling foreign surplus savings to America by buying its treasury securities. So in effect, he's saying that America forces its allies to buy its bonds. Basically, the Bank of England and the Bank of France and all these other central banks, they have no choice other than to pick up these securities. Otherwise, they're going to, there's going to be trouble. And I guess the ultimate leverage is the American army, right? And in fact, Hudson gives various examples of the Americans leaning on the Germans to buy US Treasury securities, basically in exchange for the American army still being there, i.e. you should thank us for having the army there. You should thank us, Germany, for us providing your security, but you're going to have to pay for it through this mechanism of buying up our securities. So let me talk you through a couple of examples to try to make this. It's all quite abstract and complicated, so I'm going to try to make it more concrete by offering some real examples. Let us say an American firm buys a British firm. Famously, of course, Kraft bought Cadbury's, one of the biggest corporate deals in history, and one of the most controversial ones too. So let's say an American firm buys a British firm for $19.5 billion, which was the amount that Cadbury's was bought for. First, the money used to finance the purchase in the first place is often borrowed. This was the case when Kraft borrowed over $7 billion to buy Cadbury's in a hostile takeover in 2009. And this practice of leveraging debt in order to do a buyout and then saddling the company with that debt is another thing. I mean, it's a topic for another day, but famously the Glazers did this to Manchester United, and there are countless other examples of that happening. Second, some portion of the assets used in that purchase creates a surplus of dollars in the British economy, which end up back at the Bank of England. Third, the Bank of England then recycles those dollars by buying up US Treasury bills. Thus, the Bank of England ends up holding US debt, while the USA ends up getting US dollars back from Britain, as I explained earlier on. Britain and other creditor nations thus end up financing American purchases of their own nation's assets. It's kind of a roundabout and crazy, but you can see how this works. Where do those dollars come from? I mean, remember, to pay people in Britain to do stuff in Britain, you need to have pound sterling. To do stuff in America, you need to have dollars. If a company comes in trying to do something with dollars, it needs to change those into pounds. Those dollars don't just disappear. They have to go somewhere, and they end up back at the Bank of England. Those dollars then, they have to do something with them, and they end up buying US Treasury bills or bonds or whatever else, and round we go. Another example, one that Hudson is particularly interested in, is the example of privatization. If a state such as the UK sells off its national utilities, there are many new opportunities for dollar recycling. First, an investment bank, usually American, will advise and facilitate any such processes for large fees. Famously, of course, Goldman Sachs, who I've already mentioned, advised the British government and British Gas on its privatization in 1986. This was obviously a big money deal for Goldman Sachs. Second, if a US firm buys up the asset, the same process takes place as in the private takeover, as I just explained. I mean, let's say it was Kraft buying up, British Gas. Not that Kraft would ever buy British Gas, but you know what I'm talking about. Let's say it was an American firm buying up British Gas. The same merry-go-round I just explained would also take place here. Third, if a US firm wins a government contract, this can generate more dollar recycling. And American firms regularly do win massive contracts from the British government, not least, of course, the likes of AstraZeneca, Pfizer, various other big pharma firms, as happened during the pandemic. But it's not just healthcare, it's across the board whenever privatizations have happened. Thus, as in the prior example, Britain partially funds the American buyout of its own assets. Here is Hudson. He says, what is novel about America's new state capitalist form of imperialism is that it uses states and their central banks as vehicles to siphon off financial surpluses via the Treasury bill standard, not private firms. What turns the US key currency imperialism into a veritable super imperialism is that the privilege of running free deficits belongs to one nation alone, not to other states. Only the credit creating centers, Federal Reserve and Treasury, and the international monetary institutions that US diplomats control are able to create credit to buy up assets and exports of foreign countries, turning them into financial satellites. The result is that whereas a century ago, national states were permitted to exploit only their own citizens by creating money and credit, the unique feature of super imperialism is that the governments in Europe and Asia, the Third World and former Soviet sphere, may now tap the wealth of their citizens, only to be tapped in turn by the imperial American center. You'll notice, by the way, that America, unlike Britain or pretty much any other country you can think of, has never had to suffer, quote unquote, austerity. There is never austerity in America. There's never any attempt to balance the books of the United States government. And that is because Democrats and Republicans alike fundamentally understand this situation. That debt can basically go on and on as long as this situation exists. The key to understanding today's dollar standard is to see that it has become a debt standard based on US Treasury IOUs, not on assets in the form of gold bullion. While applying creditor-oriented rules against third world countries and other debtors, with the IMF imposing financial austerity on these hapless countries, the Washington Consensus promotes domestic US credit expansion, indeed a real estate and a stock market bubble, untrammeled by Americans' own deepening trade deficit. And while the US government runs up debts to foreign governments and the central banks of Europe and Asia, US investors buy up the privatized public enterprises of their own economies. The World Bank pursues its own double standard by demanding privatization of foreign public sectors while financing dependency rather than self-sufficiency, above all in the sphere of food production. So how do we stop this? How does anybody want to stop this? And is de-dollarization a goer? Now, at this point, it is only speculation, and this is something I encourage you to discuss in the show notes below. Do discuss this, I encourage you to. But Hudson seems to think that the only way that this can be stopped is if the nations of the world call America's bluff and basically stop buying up US treasuries. You know, yeah, crash the world economy if you want. We're not going to have it anymore. And, of course, the other way is by disrupting the unipolar world that existed, you know, for all of this time, especially since the Cold War. And he points to Russia and China as being the ones who were able to do this. And given that he published the last edition of this in 2021, it's very interesting what has happened since the Ukraine war and how much talk of de-dollarization there is around. Other people point to Bitcoin. Some people talk about a universal currency. But a lot of signs point to the fact that America may not be able to enjoy this unique and frankly messed up situation for much longer. And then it will be interesting to see how forgiving the rest of the world, who have basically seen their economies trashed during this period, sold off, hoard out, call it what you will, how forgiving they will be of the Americans when the chickens come home to roost. All right, I'll stop there. Do buy my courses at the Academic Agency. Like and subscribe. Most importantly of all, friends, get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.